Her laughter was loud and gay and unaffected. Her mouth was a little too large, but her lips were velvety as rose petals and sweetly shaped. Her teeth were large and square and white as bone china porcelain. And as she laughed, her tongue, furry pink as that of a cat, curled between them. Her eyes were green and wide-spaced. Her skin was that lustrous, silky English perfection that neither sun nor massive doses of anti-malarial quinine could mar. She would have been striking even without the dense tresses of copper-blonde hair ruffled by the wind and wild as the sea that tumbled upon her face and shoulders. She riveted the attention of every man there, even Mr. Rhodes. But it was to Ralph she ran, holding his son on her hip still, and she drew her free arm around his neck. She was so tall that she had only to stand on her toes to reach his lips. The kiss was not long held, but her lips were soft and wet. The pressure of her breasts through her cotton blouse was springy and elastic and warm against his chest, and her thighs against his sent a shock up his spine, so that Ralph broke the embrace, and for an instant her green eyes mocked him, dared him to something that she did not fully understand, revelling in this heady sense of power over all mankind that she had not yet tested to its limits. Then she tossed Jonathan to Ralph and whirled away to run barefoot down the tent and launched herself into Jordan's arms. "Darling Jordan, oh, how we've missed you!" She forced him into a prancing jig around the stockade, shaking out her shining hair and caroling joyously. Ralph glanced at Mr. Rhodes, and when he saw his expression of shock and unease, he grinned and released Jonathan, letting him race across to cling to Vicky's skirt and add his shrill voice to the uproar. Then he turned to greet the second twin. Elizabeth was as tall as Vicky, but darker. Her hair was polished mahogany, shot through with sparks of burgundy, and her skin was sun-kindly, gilded to the colour of a tiger's eyes. She was slim as a dancer, with a narrow waist and shoulders supporting a long heron neck, and her breasts were smaller than Vicky's, yet elegantly pointed, and though her voice was soft, and her laughter a throaty purr, yet there was a mischievous quirk to her lips, a jaunty tilt to her head, and a measured sexual candour and awareness to the gaze of her wild honey eyes. She and Cathy were arm in arm, but now she slipped out of her elder sister's embrace and presented herself to Ralph. "My favourite brother-in-law," she murmured. And looking into her eyes, Ralph was reminded that though her voice was softer, and her manner seemingly more restrained than that of her twin, yet Elizabeth was always the instigator and prime mover in any mischief that the pair conjured up. Thus close, her true beauty was apparent. Less flamboyant than Vicky's, perhaps, but the balance of her features and the depths beyond those golden brown eyes were more disturbing. She kissed Ralph, and the contact was as brief, but even less sisterly, than had been the elder twin's embrace. And as she drew back from it, she slanted her eyes with a pretense of innocence that was more deadly than any brazening. Ralph broke the electric contact and looked to Cathy, making a comical mow of resignation, and hoping that she still believed his studied avoidance of the twins was because he found them boisterous and childish. Flushed and panting, Vicky released Jordan, placed her hands on her hips, and asked Ralph, "Ralph, are you not going to present us to the company?" "Mr. Rhodes, may I present my sisters-in-law?" said Ralph with relish. "Oh, the famous Mr. Rhodes!" Vicky gushed theatrically. But there were little green sparks in her eyes. "It is such an honour to meet the conqueror of the Matabele nation, because, you see, King Lobengula was a personal friend of our family." "Please excuse my sister, Mr. Rhodes," Elizabeth curtsied, and her expression was demure. "She intends no discourtesy, but our parents were the first missionaries to the Matabele, and our father sacrificed his life trying to help Lobengula, while your troops were pursuing him to his death. My mother..." "Young lady, I am fully aware who your mother is," Mr. Rhodes forestalled her sharply.
"Oh, good," Vicky chimed sweetly. "Then you will appreciate the gift that she asked me to present to you."
Vicky reached into the deep pocket of her long skirt and brought out a thin volume. It was bound in cardboard, not Morocco leather, and the quality of the yellow paper was coarse and matte. She laid it on the trestle table in front of Mr. Rhodes, and when he saw the title, his heavy jaw clamped closed. Even Ralph quailed slightly. He had counted on the twins providing an unsettling influence, but he had not expected them to be so instantly explosive. The book was entitled Trooper Hackett of Matabeleland by Robin Ballantyne, for the twins' mother wrote and published under her maiden name. There was probably not a man in the stockade who had not already read the slim volume or at least heard of its contents, and if Vicky had thrown a live mamba on the table, their consternation could not have been more intense. The contents of the book were so dangerous that three reputable London publishers had rejected it, and finally Robin St. John had published it privately and created an immediate sensation. In 6 months it had sold almost 200,000 copies and had been treated to extensive reviews in almost every influential newspaper both at home in England and abroad in the colonies. The frontispiece of the book set the tone for the text that followed. It was a murky photograph that depicted a dozen white men in British South Africa Company uniform standing under the spreading branches of a tall wild teak tree and looking up at the corpses of four semi-naked Matabele hanging by their necks from the topmost branches. There was no caption to the photograph, and the faces of the white men were too indistinct to be recognisable. Now Mr. Rhodes reached out and opened the book at the gruesome illustration. "Those are four Matabele indunas who were wounded at the Battle of Bembezi and who committed suicide by hanging rather than surrender to our forces," he growled. "They are not the victims of some atrocity, as this scurrilous piece of offal implies." Mr. Rhodes closed the book with a snap, and Elizabeth exclaimed sweetly, "Oh, Mr. Rhodes, Mamma will be so disappointed that you did not enjoy her little story." The book described the fictional adventures of Trooper Hackett of the British South Africa Company Expeditionary Force, and his wholehearted participation in the slaughter of the Matabele with machine-gun fire, the pursuit and shooting down of the fleeing survivors, the burning of the kraals, the looting of Lobengula's cattle, and the rape of the young Matabele girls. Then Trooper Hackett is separated from his squadron and spends the night alone on a wild koppie, and while huddled over his campfire, a mysterious white stranger comes out of the night and joins him at the fire. Hackett remarks, "Ah, you have been in the wars too, I see," leaning forward and inspecting the stranger's feet. "By God, both of them, and right through. You must have had a bad time of it." And the stranger replies, "It all happened a very long time ago." Then the reader is left in no doubt as to whom he is dealing with, especially when the author describes his beautiful, gentle countenance and his all-seeing blue eyes. Abruptly, the stranger breaks into a florid injunction to young Hackett. "Take a message to England. Go to that great people and demand of them, where is the sword that was given into your hand, that with it you might enforce justice and deal out mercy? How came you to give it up into the hands of men who search for gold, whose thirst is wealth, to whom the souls and bodies of their fellow men are counters in a game, men who have transformed the sword of a great people into a tool to burrow for gold, as the snouts of swine for earth nuts?" It was little wonder, Ralph smiled to himself, that Mr. Rhodes pushed the book away and wiped the hand that touched it on the lapel of his rumpled Norfolk jacket. "Oh, Mr. Rhodes," murmured Vicky, angel-faced and wide-eyed, "at the least you must read the inscription that Mamma dedicated to you." She retrieved the discarded volume, opened the fly-leaf and read aloud, "For Cecil John Rhodes, without whose endeavours this book would never have been written." Mr. Rhodes rose from his seat with ponderous dignity. "Ralph," he said quietly, "thank you for your hospitality. Dr. Jim and I will be getting on to Bulawayo, I think. We have spent too long here as it is." Then he looked across at Jordan. "The mules are well rested. Jordan, is there a moon tonight?"
There will be a good moon tonight," Jordan replied promptly, "and there are no clouds, so we will have a good light for the road."
"Can we be ready to leave by this evening, then?"
It was a command, and Mr. Rhodes did not wait for a reply, but stalked out of the stockade towards his own tent, and the little doctor followed him stiffly. The moment they were gone,
The twins burst into merry, tinkling laughter and hugged each other ecstatically.
"Mamma would have been proud of you, Victoria, Isabel."
"Well, I'm not," Jordan's voice cut through their hilarity. He was white-faced and shaking with anger. "You are ill-mannered and silly little girls."
"Oh, Jordan," Vicky wailed and seized his hands. "Don't be cross. We love you so."
"Yes, we do, both of us," Elizabeth took his other hand. But he pulled away from them.
"You do not have any idea in those giddy little heads how dangerous a game you are playing, not only for yourself," he strode away from them, but paused for a moment in front of Ralph.
"Nor do you, Ralph." His expression softened, and he placed his hand on Ralph's shoulder.
"Please be more careful, for my sake, if not for your own."
Then he followed his master from the stockade. Ralph pulled the gold hunter from the inner pocket of his waistcoat and made a show of inspecting it.
"Well," he announced to the twins, 16 minutes to clear the camp. That must be a new record even for you two."
He returned the watch to his pocket and put one arm around Cathy's shoulders.
"There you are, Katie, my love. There is your home again, without a single stranger."
"That is not quite the case," murmured a soft American accent, and Harry Mellow rose from the log he had been using as a seat and removed the slouch hat from his curly head. The twins stared at him for a startled instant, then flashed each other a look of complete accord, and a remarkable transformation came over them. Liza smoothed her skirts, and Vicky pushed back the dense, dangling tresses from her face, and their expressions became grave and their comportment ladylike.
"You may present the young gentleman, Cousin Ralph," said Vicky, in accents so refined as to make Ralph glance at her to confirm it was the same girl speaking. When the mule coach drove through the outer gates of the stockade, there was one member of Mr. Rhodes's party who was not aboard.
"What did you tell Mr. Rhodes?" Cathy asked, hanging onto Ralph's arm as they watched the coach rolling away.
A dark shadow on the moon's silver road.
"I told him that I needed Harry for a day or two more to help me lay out the development for the Harkness."
Ralph lit his last cheroot of the day, and they began the leisurely stroll around the camp that was a little ritual of their life together. It was their time of contentment and delicious anticipation, the time when they talked over the events of the day just past and planned for the one ahead, at the same time touching each other as they walked, her hand in the crook of his arm, their hips sliding against each other, a closeness which would soon lead naturally and sweetly to the wide, soft cot in the bell tent.
"Was that true?" Cathy asked.
"Semi-true," he admitted. "I need him for longer than a day or two, more like 10 or 20 years."
"If you succeed, you'll be one of the few men to get the better of Mr. Rhodes, and he will not like it."
Ralph stopped her and commanded, "Listen!"
From the inner stockade there was the orange glow of a fire, and the sound of a banjo being played with such rare skill that the limpid notes shimmered and ran into each other. Like some exotic bird song, it rose to an impossible crescendo and then ceased so abruptly that the utter stillness trembled in the air for many seconds before the night chorus of the cicadas in the trees, which had been shamed to silence by the vaunting instrument, hesitatingly recommenced. With it mingled the patter of soft palms and the twins' unfeigned exclamations of delight.
"He's a man of many talents, your Harry Mellow. The chief of them is that he can spot gold in a filled tooth across a polo field. However, I have no doubt that your little sisters will come to cherish others of his accomplishments."
"I should send them to bed," Cathy murmured.
"Don't be the wicked elder sister," Ralph admonished, and the music started again. But this time, Harry Mellow's soaring baritone led, and the twins picked up the refrain in their true, clear voices.
"Leave the poor creatures alone. They have enough of that at home." Ralph led her away.
"It's my duty," Cathy protested half-heartedly.
"If it's duty you're after," Ralph chuckled, "then, by God, woman, I have another more pressing duty for you to perform."
He lay stretched out on his back on the cot and watched her prepare for bed in the lamplight. It had taken her a long time to forget her upbringing as the child of Christian missionaries, and to allow him to watch her. But now she had come to enjoy it, and she flaunted a little before him, until he grinned and leaned out of the cot to crush out the cheroot,
then lift both hands towards her. "Come here, Katie," he ordered. But she hung back provocatively. "Do you know what I want?" "No, but I know what I want. I want a home." "You have a home?" "I want a home with thatch and brick walls and a real garden." "You have a garden. The most beautiful garden in the world. And it stretches from the Limpopo to the Zambezi." "I want a house. I want a garden with roses and geraniums." She came to him, and he lifted the sheet. "Will you build me a home, Ralph?" "Yes." "When?" "When the railroad is finished." She sighed softly. He had made the same promise while he was laying the telegraph line, and that was before Jonathan was born. But she knew better than to remind him. Instead, she slipped under the sheet, and strangely his arms, as they closed around her, became home for that moment.